a Birdificer creation.
Welcome to episode 150 of the Let's Talk Apple podcast. I'm your host, Bart Bouchotz, and this is the show for February 2026. We have a surprisingly large amount of main stories to get into, so let's quickly get stuck into the short month's long list of Apple news. A few follow-ups to start us off. We spoke at the end of the last show. One of our stories was about Tim Cook getting into a little bit of hot water by going to the White House literally the day Alex Preti was murdered by ICE agents, and things were getting quite to a head, shall we say, in Minneapolis. Well, the fallout from that continued a little bit into the start of February. Tim Cook sent a letter to all, or a note, or whatever they call them, a memo, I think, is officially, to Apple employees, which basically both sided the whole thing, and it was, I'm going to just describe it as weak as dishwater. Other critiques of it are a lot harsher than weak as dishwater, but it was pathetic, in my opinion. You are, of course, free to have your own opinion. That is the joy of democratic life. Meanwhile, the lead Democrat on the House Judicial Committee wrote to Attorney General Pam Bondi to ask why the First Amendment violations of the orders to Apple and Google to remove IceBlock are not being investigated by the DOJ. Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing you have to do because that's the person you're supposed to write to. Obviously, that's going to achieve nothing. But it is kind of interesting to sort of draw attention again to the fact that, hey, Apple and Google, First Amendment, you guys just sort of wiped your hands of it by removing material that wasn't illegal because you thought it might get you some favors with the administration or avoid some rash of the administration. Disappointing. Again, you know my feelings on this. You are, of course, free to have your own different feelings on this, but again, that is where we are. Meanwhile, we talked about Apple launching their first bundle, or subscription bundle for their Pro apps, the Apple Creator Studio. One of the weird things about that bundle is that the Office apps are grouped into it, especially the AI features in the Office apps, and it turns out that they're not all that good. Because if you actually try to use them, you will run headlong into usage limits surprisingly quickly. A lot more quickly than you will with other AI tools, and a lot more quickly than you're probably going to want, assuming you are actually doing any of this AI stuff. So, all in all, I think Apple still have some homework to do on this one. Moving into our regulatory rundown, Apple Maps and Apple Ads aren't popular enough to be regulated in the EU, is the headline Apple Insider chose. Basically, the Digital Markets Act puts extra regulation on companies whose apps reach a threshold, a large threshold, to become a very large online platform or a VLOP. And Apple have argued that actually Apple Maps and Apple Ads are nowhere near large enough for that kind of extra regulation, and the European Commission agreed. So it's not that they aren't popular enough to regulate. They're still regulated under all the normal rules for all the companies that are not extra big. It's just they don't have extra responsibilities from being very large. So I think Apple are probably happy, maybe too strong a word, but less cranky than they have been of late at the European Union. Jumping us across the small little English channel, we arrive in the United Kingdom, where, for now at least, both Apple and Google are not really having to do very much for the UK's new Competition and Markets Act, the CMA. They've made some token promises, a few press releases basically saying they promise to be very fair to developers, and for now The UK's Competition and Markets Authority are happy to take them at their word, but they do say they'll be watching. So maybe that will develop into something over the next few years. But for now, at least, the CMA is not a new DMA from Apple's point of view. Spanish regulators, meanwhile, have ruled that Apple and Amazon dragged their feet implementing a ruling against them for 15 months. So if they prove that, or if they succeed in that, that was likely to lead to those companies being fined more. This is kind of silly. It's like they did eventually make the changes, so it's not like nothing. It's not like they didn't do it, or it's not like they're still fighting it or anything. They just were very, very slow. And that just seems like a bad idea. That's just going to make regulators cranky with you anyway. That we are where we are. And jumping across the giant big ocean, or pond, as myself and a friend of the show, Alessia Sheridan, call it, to Brazil. Apple have been fined by a single Brazilian state for including chargers with their iPhones. Sorry, for not including chargers with their iPhones, because, hey, who doesn't have enough e-waste? Now that we have standardized ports, why should we just keep wasting plastic and very, very valuable copper and just throwing it away? Why don't we force companies to be that wasteful? Well done, Brazil. Can you detect that maybe I think this is dumb? Which I do. Legal latest, then. The XAI versus Apple and OpenAI cases continuing to rumble on. Somewhat unusual development. OpenAI have submitted documents to the court accusing XAI of destroying evidence, basically blowing up their own documents before launching this case because, well, we don't know why the because apparently they're gone. So interesting. We'll see how that develops. That case, generally speaking, is not going XAI's way. Yeah, no, it hasn't gone their way so far. Meanwhile, Apple's case against the iOS 26 leakers, you know, John Prosser being the most noteworthy name in that case, but he's not the only name in that case because he worked with former Apple employees to get this early, early access to what we now know as iOS 26. The court is confirming that even though a default judgment has been entered against John Prosser, he has still been subpoenaed for a deposition because, of course, the case goes on against the others who are pleading not guilty. And so John Prosser has to give evidence for or against about them. So that could be an interesting moment. So he now has to engage with a case he's been busy avoiding and has actually been default ruled against. No, you know, we don't yet know what that's going to mean for him, but he didn't bother filing the paperwork. I'm not a lawyer, so maybe my opinion doesn't matter, but it doesn't sound like he's engaging with this in a very useful way. But anyway, we shall see. West Virginia, as in the state, are suing Apple because they gave in to pressure and reason and abandoned their on-device anti-CSAM scanning plans and switched instead to proactive protection tools. They're now being sued because they didn't follow through on those misguided plans. So I'm happy Apple didn't follow through. West Virginia, not so much. Apple have come up again in the United States Department of Justice case against Google. This is an antitrust case against Google because, well, it's a much, much bigger case. But one of the things in that case is how much Google pay Apple for being the default search in Safari on all of Apple's platform. On the Mac, that doesn't mean very much, but in iPhone land, that's hugely valuable. And that's Google buying an awful lot of default traffic. And that is obviously at issue in an antitrust case against Google. Where things had settled was that Apple and Google's deal was fine. Unfortunately for Apple, a whole bunch of state attorneys general and the Department of Justice are basically appealing that. So all of this is going back to court, and the question of that Google-Apple deal is up in the air again, potentially, depending on They filed an appeal. That doesn't mean the appeal will be accepted, and if so, maybe it won't go back to court, but it probably will. So they're not quite settled yet. And then finally, a little bit of good news to end on. Apple wins third trial in long-running Optus LTE case, avoids millions in damages. So I'll just quote from the Mac Observer for the meat of this one. Apple has won a major patent lawsuit in Texas, of all places. That's me inserting myself here. Texas, the jurisdiction everyone goes to for patent trolling. So even in Texas, Apple have won this one. Excuse me, I'll go back to the quote now. After a jury ruled that it did not infringe any patents owned by Optus Wireless, the case centered on five LTE patents that Optus claimed Apple violated through its iPhones and other devices. Very big deal, LTE connectivity, slightly important to, say, the iPhone, the iPad, you know, kind of important. Oh, and the Apple Watch. Jumping quickly into the section is always called Apple HR and Acquisitions News, and most of the time it's HR news and no acquisitions. This month it's two acquisitions and no HR news, which is unusual. So Apple buys the graph database startup Kuzu, as shown by an EU filing. Some interesting context is that this is a sort of a database-like structure, a bit like FileMaker. That's sort of a non-structured data database. So a lot of speculation about what Apple might do with that. And the obvious shortcoming in the iWork suite is a database of some sort to compete with Microsoft Access in the Microsoft Office suite. Don't know if that's what they're going to use this for, but it's certainly the kind of technology that could be amazing to make something like FileMaker Lite or FileMaker Simpler as part of iWork. Interesting. Apple then also acquired Inverse.io assets and hires founder Mark Schubert. This is largely being described as an aqua hire. And it is about AI, but the domain name is old enough to end in .io instead of .ai. And that's because this is mostly about image processing. So what we're looking at here is almost certainly hiring someone who's fantastic at that magic image pipeline, that amazing machine learning that sits between the light hitting the sensor and the photo appearing in the camera app in the iPhone. And that's one of the iPhone's really big strengths. If you listen to Let's Talk Photography, I regularly talk about that. So this seems to be a hire to make the cameras in the iPhones even better, and they're already darn impressive cameras. Moving on to Apple services and original content highlights. So quite a bit going on in the world of Apple Arcade and gaming in general on Apple's platforms. So set sail in Oceanhorn 3 Legend of the Shadow, an exciting new chapter in the hit action-adventure franchise on Apple Arcade, March 5th, is Apple's press release. Apparently, because I know very little about gaming, this is the best RPG on Apple Arcade. Getting a sequel is how Cult of Mac summarizes it, so I will take their word for that. Again, I don't understand this fully, apart from the fact that the Mac Observer tells me that this is big news, and, well, to be honest, they've earned my trust, so I think it probably is. Crimson Desert launches on macOS March 19th with day one release. At the day one release bit, I immediately grok as being, okay, that is significant. So apparently this is a AAA title, which apparently is the game world lingo for a game people actually care about. And on its actual launch day, it is arriving simultaneously on the Mac, the PC, the PlayStation, and the Xbox. To see the Mac in that same list there is impressive. So that is news. And then a company called Gamesir is bringing an emulator app called Game Hub to macOS, promising that your Mac is now a gaming PC. Well, there's certainly enough silicon in modern Macs to be able to do emulation shockingly fast, so it's certainly interesting that they've released this as a product. It's not an open source tinker tool, it's a product, so I don't know enough to know how good it'll be at emulating and whether or not that's a ridiculous claim that your Mac is now a gaming PC, but it's interesting to see someone putting the time and effort into a product and bringing that product to market. So I think that's why it caught my eye. Very briefly moving to the abandoned product area of Apple Home. Still no actual news from Apple, but there's Apple adjacent news. One of the standards Apple has been working hard to help implement is something called Aliro, which is a standard for making smart locks work seamlessly across all the various platforms, both in terms of security, which is rather important for a smart lock. It needs to actually lock your door reliably, and also in terms of interacting with the unlocking of your door when it's needed, which is also really important for a smart lock. So how reliable will it be with your watch, your phone, whether that be an Android, an iPhone, etc. And so this standard is like, it's like Thread and Matter, but the extra bits that Thread and Matter as in and of themselves don't provide for smart locks. Sort of, it's like it builds on top of that standardization work to give a standard for smart locks. Very promising. It opens up a lot of avenues. For now, it looks like it'll be third parties making use of this, but it is important for Apple ecosystem users who are interested in smart locks. Apple in the car, we have some news, not a huge amount, but some. Apple car key support is now available in the 2026 Toyota RAV4. I don't know how big of a model that is in the United States, but here in Europe, the RAV4 is a very, very popular model from Toyota. So that is actually a big deal, certainly here in Europe. I don't believe this is a big deal here in Europe, but definitely significant for people into high-end EVs in America. Rivian launches Apple Watch app with battery and cabin controls. And we are going to get AI agents, which is basically third, you know, non-Siri Siri, in Apple CarPlay. But these agents are not going to be allowed to actually control the car. Probably better for all of our safety. And there's all sorts of rules on these agents' use of the screen. They need to interact with you via voice, basically. So Apple have made these APIs available in such a way so as not to distract from driving, which is definitely something I want my CarPlay to do. I don't really want things I run on CarPlay to distract me from the driving thing I'm supposed to be doing for my health and the health of every other road user in my case in Ireland, but you get what I mean. So I like that Apple are thinking about this kind of thing. Apple Music then, Bad Bunny wins Grammy Album of the Year ahead of Super Bowl halftime show. Apple celebrates Super Bowl LX60 with Bad Bunny across multiple Apple Music, or across Apple Music and more, sorry. Basically, a bunch of Apple products, they really featured Bad Bunny. Apparently, it was a good show. Bad Bunny's Apple Music Super Bowl halftime show breaks records worldwide. Apple Music Connect has been reborn, not as a social media tool that never took off for us users of Apple Music, but as a marketing tool to help the music industry get the word out about their artists. We shall see how that works. And if you live in Germany and are a fan of the somewhat niche chocolate brand with the strange name Ritter Sport, I never associate chocolate bars with sport. I always found that brand very strange. We have the brand in Ireland, but with English language packaging. And apparently, I know from listening to Ken Ray, it also exists in the United States of America. In Germany, however, in the German language packaging, there is a sort of a crossover with Apple Music, where there is not just album covers on the chocolate bars, but also QR codes, which when you scan, get you free stuff on Apple Music and trials and things like that. So it's an interesting collaboration. I'd be curious if that kind of thing spreads. The Ritter bars are very square and flat in their shape, so they're actually a perfect shape to put QR codes and things on compared to like a Mars bar or something, which is a very difficult shape to do that kind of thing with. Anyway, very interesting. But alas, not going to see it here in my Irish supermarkets. Sport is another thing Apple are really focusing in on in terms of their original content. So the Formula One channel has appeared on Apple TVs in America and you can't remove it. Like the MLB channel, I really, as a paying customer of Apple, I morally object to being forced to have their content thrust on me. It's like putting forced ads, calling them trailers, and then saying there are no ads in HBO, or not HBO, Paramount Plus. I find that obnoxious and objectionable. I am paying you. Give me the content I want. That's why I'm paying you. Anyway, sorry about that. I'll get off my little soapbox here. I don't think I'm alone, though. The internet seemed to rather be on my side on this one. According to the headline from Apple Insider, race to IMAX theater. Apple TV and F1 will screen live races. That does rather, I mean, they have immersive content for the Apple Vision, Vision Pro. But, you know, very few people have those devices. You can't even get them here in Ireland. So IMAX is certainly second best for that kind of immersive content. So interesting thought. Apple announces F1 details and a surprising Netflix partnership. Given how hostile Netflix has been towards doing anything Apple-y on the Apple TV, trust me, nuts that they refuse to integrate with the TV app, for example, they've agreed to do a content swap. Live race coverage is being given to Netflix from Apple in exchange for Apple TV getting to show Drive to Survive, which is a documentary series which is apparently extremely big in the United States about Formula One. Apple Maps then is, again, they did this last year too, is getting a whole bunch of content for Formula One races. Apple Sports app is getting some more sport scores. In this case, it's golf, PGA and WPGA tours specifically, which is the Professional Golf Association and the Women's Professional Golf Association, I think. Kind of educated guessing that one, to be honest. I'm not really into golf. Nor am I into sports ball, so this one also isn't big for me. MLS kicks off 2026 season on Apple TV with new feature on World Cup Spotlight. Of course, the World Cup is coming to the United States. Big deal for soccer. And finally, Apple TV Formula One MLS MLB streaming reach expands to bars and restaurants. They've done a deal with one of the companies that sends content to bars and restaurants to have Apple TV content going to those bars and restaurants. It's an interesting way to advertise Apple TV, and obviously it's a revenue stream. They're paying for that content, so interesting. Okay, and then finally jumping to Apple TV itself. Apple has released their 2026 lineup for Apple TV, and do you know something? It's really impressive. A lot of people were very worried that Apple are only doing the original content. I mean, that means there's going to be nothing to watch on Apple TV. Well, they've gotten pretty darn good at it, and if you look through that list, I mean, you're going to find something different to what I found. But lots of very interesting looking stuff. For me personally, For All Mankind and Ted Lasso, yay. But lots more in there. So link in show notes at lestashtalk.ie. Apple have bought Severance. So as Apple Insider put it, Severance acquired by Apple for $70 million. Expect a 4-season run and spin-offs. Roku has added Apple TV to the Roku Channel Premium lineup, so you can buy your Apple TV straight through your Roku Channel Premium. That is another nice way to sell stuff. And just a few more awards. Thankfully, just a few. I'm not being sarcastic. Apple TV has earned a Grammy win with the F1 movie soundtrack. And The Studio and Mr. Scorsese are honored at the Directors Guild Award. The Directors Guild Awards. Jesus, that's hard to say. Okay. We are now ready for our main story. So we need to start, unfortunately, in Trumplandia for some big tariff news. But then we get to move on a little bit to some rather related news about a notable push into US manufacturing in Houston, Texas. And then we get to have fun. Then we get to talk about the March experience that Apple ran simultaneously in New York, London and Shanghai. It was an unusual event and lots of very interesting products for us to get stuck into. Our first main story then is confirmation from the US Supreme Court of the bloody obvious. The actual legal basis under which President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs were declared was bogus. It was nonsense. The law didn't say that. Even non-lawyer me could see that. The whole thing was an attempted power grab for the executive branch to grab powers the Constitution gives to not the executive branch, to Congress. And even a Supreme Court not known for its balance at present was able to get to a 6-3 decision. So not a 5-4 like you might expect, but a 6-3, which means that people appointed by President Trump were also on the side pointing out that these tariffs are in fact not legal. So all of this revolves around IEEPA, which I did at one point this month remember what it stood for. It's basically a law that grants certain powers to the president, but not the tariff powers the president took it to grant him. And since the Constitution is actually pretty explicit that tariff powers actually sit with Congress, it also calls them taxes, which they are. Anyway, the Supreme Court said IEEPA does not actually grant the president the power to just issue tariffs. Therefore, that power rests with Congress, not the president. Therefore, these tariffs are illegal. Everyone knew this was coming. Had the president put on a show of being surprised and cranky and annoyed, but he also simultaneously had had all of the prep work in place to be ready with other laws. So literally, within hours of the ruling, Trump announced a new worldwide flat tariff of 10% under Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act, which allows presidents to impose emergency. Now, it actually says import controls rather than tariffs, so there is some ambiguity as to whether or not maybe we could, you know, maybe someone could file a lawsuit saying that actually even this bill doesn't give you tariff control, it gives you import controls, but that's a much, much, much weaker case than the IEEPA case. The interesting thing here, though, the thing to put a pin in, is that whatever it is the president's allowed to do under Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act, he's only allowed to do it for 150 days, at which point he needs congressional approval for it to continue. So we are sort of marching towards some sort of a constitutional crisis here, where the 150 days are likely to run out, and we won't really know what's going on. There was also a lot of bluster about raising the 10% to the maximum allowable 15% under this regulation. Well, that didn't happen because, well, we don't know the because we don't really get official becauses, certainly not ones that comport with reality. However, an interesting correlation in time is that the markets went nuts at the concept. The markets reacted very badly to these threats. Well, you never know what a market reacts to, but the threats were happening. They were the biggest news in the world. The markets were not happy. So it seems, you know, I don't like saying, oh, the market did this because that, because it's very hard to assign a because to the markets. They're vague, amorphous things. But in this case, I think it's pretty clear the markets were not happy at the concept of a 15% flat tariff. So that vanished into the ether around about the time the markets went nuts, and I don't think those two are disconnected. If you're looking for a good summary of what all of this uncertainty means from Apple's point of view, the Mac Observer have a good breakdown of it over link in show notes, lessertalk.ie. And Cult of Mac have a has some nice sort of analysis as well. The thing that they point out, also link in show notes, by the way, is that these blunter tariffs are actually worse for Apple. So the number is smaller. 10% is less than the various, you know, up to 50% tariffs on other countries. Some of them are even higher, I think. The problem is these are flat tariffs. So that means that Apple's exemptions evaporate because these are flat tariffs. So for Apple, this is actually worse, even though the number looks smaller. For most of the American economy, this is better. Better is the wrong word. Less bad. And in related news, the Trump-appointed Federal Trade Commission warns Apple News over its alleged conservative bias. Yes, Apple News is actually quite reality-focused. And I'm afraid to say that contact with reality is not evenly distributed between the US political parties at present. Our second main story could be argued to be main story 1B, but we don't have that many main stories, so I called it main story number two. Apple ramps up US manufacturing in Houston, Texas. That's literally the wording. Well, that's my description of Apple's press release. Basically, Apple is going to make Mac Minis for the United States in the United States. It's one of their smallest products by number. So compared to iPhones, they make like two orders of magnitude fewer of them per year. But it's a good, it's the kind of thing that is much more buildable in the United States because it's not as small and fiddly because, you know, it's very similar technology in a much bigger box that's easier to manufacture. And again, if you build it in America for the American market, you don't have to pay tariffs on it. So, you know, and it looks really much in line with what the American administration would like to encourage. So this just makes all the sense in the world for Apple to do. Apple's press release also mentions that more Apple AI servers are going to be produced in Texas. Because of transparency measures Apple put in place in private cloud compute, we also know that they're moving those servers to M5 chips. So one of the things that makes private cloud compute so trustworthy is that the operating system is actually open to be inspected by cybersecurity researchers and then cryptographically signed so that you know that the version running in actual cloud compute is actually the version checked by the cybersecurity researchers, which is really cool. Apple have done a lot to make private cloud compute provably private. And because of all of that transparency, we now know they're moving to M5 chips, which is only a good thing, assuming Siri ever gets smarter this year. Apple paired the news with some nice Wall Street Journal reporting they facilitated. So a Wall Street Journal reporter and camera crew tagged along with some Apple executives around all of the various chip-related factories scattered across the United States. You know, it's kind of fascinating, to be honest. There's a nice summary of that reporting linked in the show notes from the Mac Observer. And very much related news, Apple commits 100 million chips from, or commits to 100 million chips from TSMC's Arizona fab. Again, confirmed orders help TSMC make the stuff. And then also in related news, Apple's very public shift of a small amount of production to the US has not halted its ongoing efforts to diversify its supply chain with a new education hub opening for companies in their Indian supply chain, that is in India. So they're still expanding their Indian supply chain as well as, so they're being much quieter about the Indian stuff than they are about the US manufacturing. No big press releases. Certainly not big press releases in the United States. But nonetheless, they are continuing to do the obviously intelligent thing of diversifying their entire supply chain. And now we get to main story number 3, which I could have easily broken into main story 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 9, 10. So much to talk about. So Apple did what they called an experience. And this is a whole new structure for Apple releasing their products. We're used to this notion of a week of press releases as an alternative for the less fancy products to the keynote. Well, this is a whole new thing. They called it an experience because what they did was 3 days of press releases followed by in-person demos for the press in 3 cities across the world, New York, London, and Shanghai. So the United States, Europe, from, you know, London is on the continent of Europe, continental shelf wise. I know the English Channel is there, and then Shanghai in China. Nice spread around the world. And it was really 3 days of press releases. They got a lot in. So I've sort of putting these from smallest news to biggest news. So we got some welcome but expected evolutions. Least dramatic, it is spring. Therefore, we have new colours for things from Apple. They're spring colours. I am not tempted by a single one of them, but pastels aren't my thing. Anyway, there are new iPhone cases, Apple Watch bands, and new versions of the crossbody strap in new sort of pastel-y boring colours, in my non-fashion-y opinion. Complete listing in the Mac Observer and some nice pictures in the Mac Rumors linked in show notes. The iPad Air has gone to M4. So that is an 11-inch starting at $599 and a 13-inch at $799 with the M4. They're nice looking products. Nothing shocking. Oh yes, we've gone to the new chip in the iPad Air. But, I mean, this is the iPad for most people, so it's nice. unified memory has increased to 12, so it was 8 gigabytes and now it's 12, slightly faster memory bandwidth, and the new connectivity chips from Apple continue to arrive. The N1 is in these new iPad Airs, giving Wi-Fi 7, Bluetooth 6, and Thread. Thread is new. And if you go cellular, you're getting Apple's C1X modem as well. Next up then, new M5 MacBook Air, which gets double the storage, Wi-Fi 7, and a higher starting price, is how Apple Insider summarized it. The Mac Observer go with M5 MacBook Air costs $100 more, but now starts with 512 gigabytes of storage. Same information, differently packaged. Apple also debuted new MacBook Pros with M5 Pro and M5 Max chips. And note that the M5 Pro and M5 Max are more technically interesting than you might have imagined. So we were expecting chip bumps. We were expecting higher-end versions of the plain M5s we've seen already. And these are that. So they're expected in the sense that they are faster. But what's interesting about them is how they achieved the faster, how they achieved the more cores, etc. How did they get the M5 to go Pro and Max? Basically, the short version, the TLDR that I was able to come up with after doing a lot of reading on this, because it is actually quite fascinating. Apple have figured out how to split their cores over two silicon wafers without sacrificing unified memory, which is the architectural detail that makes the M series chip so spectacularly fast. There is one pool of RAM on the actual same piece of silicon where the CPUs, the GPUs, and the neural processing engines all sit. So on a traditional PC architecture, you have graphics memory and core memory, and as you're processing graphics, that same information is being copied over and back and over and back and over and back between graphics memory and regular memory and graphics memory and regular memory. That's awfully wasteful. With Apple's unified approach, they all use the one pool of information, so nothing has to be duplicated. It's very, very efficient, but there's a limit to how many transistors you can reliably print on the same piece of silicon. Yes, we're doing it smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to get more and more and more and more transistors in the same number of square millimeters, but it's really hard to get a chip where there are zero mistakes, and therefore the rate of them that have to be thrown in the bin because they don't pass QA goes up and up and up the more you try to put on a single piece of silicon, and we're just hitting limits. So the industry is trying to move to this idea of a chiplet, which is instead of one silicon wafer doing everything, we do it on multiple silicon wafers and find an efficient way to join them so that they effectively are one, even though they're not one. And Apple have done that already by sticking multiple chips together to give us the ultra versions of some of the earlier M numbers, but that broke unified memory. That was basically a multi-CPU system, each one with its own unified memory stuck together, with just high bandwidth between them, so the shared memory was still pretty fast, even though it wasn't technically shared anymore. Well, what's interesting here is Apple have moved to chiplets. They've broken the silicon, then they split the cores across two pieces of silicon, and yet they have retained unified memory by fusing the silicon in a certain way. So basically all of the memory is on one of the wafers along with some of the cores, and all the other chip is all cores. It's very interesting. If I'm not explaining it very well, there is a good technical analysis from Ars Technica linked in the show notes, but if you want to understand the sort of the why we care as opposed to the how on earth do they do this, then Om Malik over on his blog om.co, Omco, I guess, om.co, his explanation of why this is a big deal is fascinating, and I would recommend that to non-technical people to have a read of. It's very good to understand, okay, this is a big deal. And then the subtle details of how Apple are naming the three different types of core inside their CPUs have changed. The new names make perfect sense when you look at them on their own. The problem is they reuse words they used before in earlier M1 to M4 chips, and they now have different meanings. So the same words mean different things on an M5 than they used to mean on an M4, 3, 2, 1. That's confusing. it's paying down technical debt, because the new names are actually genuinely better. The old ones were more confusing. The problem is, this is now confusing because we've confusingly fixed the confusion. Confused? We also got some overdue display updates. I mean, we needed updates to both the Studio Display and the Pro Display XDR. And what we got was a very minimal refresh of the Studio Display. If you're buying a new one, there's some nice little tweaks to it that make it a little bit more modern. Yay! If you have a current one, like the one I'm looking at right now this second as I'm talking into this microphone, I don't need any FOMO, because basically, in terms of the panel quality, no change. If I did video podcasting, the fact that the camera in the new one apparently doesn't suck would be nice. That's probably the biggest upgrade for people. But, you know, I don't. And if I did, I'd use the nice Logitech webcam I use for video calls for work, which is sitting on another screen just right next to me. I'd use that instead. So I really don't need this display, which is great, because they're not cheap. But they are gorgeous, by the way. Gorgeous, gorgeous displays. So anyway, that's just a nice little update. No need for FOMO if you already have one of the first gen panels. They're still gorgeous screens. They remain gorgeous screens, and the new ones are just as gorgeous. The interesting thing is that there is no new Pro Display XDR. The product is instead gone. However, the features, the extra level of quality, the extra nits, the extra dynamic range, all of that extra proness of the Pro Display XDR is now available in a Studio Display XDR, which is cheaper, substantially so. It's picked up some new tricks as well. So I'll just give you the headline from Cult of Mac. Studio Display XDR arrives with mini LED backlighting and 5K clarity. What's interesting is that there is a formal standard for the displays used for displaying radiology data. X-rays, you know, imaging, basically. Not just X-rays, CAT scans, CT scans, all those things. It's a very, very specific sort of standard in terms of nits and all these kind of things, because when a technician looks at the X-ray, the same shade of grey means the same thing on every single screen. If screens were dimmer and less dim, they would be really confusing to try and interpret an image. You'd lose, you know, there would just be no correlation from image from screen to screen as you moved around as an image person. So it's very, very highly standardized so that we, you know, our healthcare is proper. And the Studio Display XDR has a preset for radiology that is certified. So normally those displays they use for looking at your X-rays and things cost an absolute bloody fortune, whereas the Studio Display XDR costs a half a fortune, shall we say. So this is actually a big deal. However, in order to drive that display at its full oomph, at its full 120 hertz, you need quite an oomphy Mac. So if your Mac isn't up to it, you may be wasting your money. So if you're curious, the Mac Observer tell you how to check if you actually could utilize the XDR-ness of the Studio Display XDR. And an interesting little side note is that the packaging for the Studio Displays has been refactored, redesigned, so it actually fits in standard recycling bins. I'm the kind of person who keeps my boxes of all of my Apple gear that I might sell secondhand. So they're all up in the attic. And I don't know. I didn't know that my box doesn't fit in the recycle bin, because I will never find that out. Because when I'm done with this screen, it will find a new home somewhere else. And it will arrive to that someone else in its original box, because that makes it so much nicer for the recipient. Also means it's, I'm less likely to break it in transit. Okay, so we, you know, not unexpected, not exactly how we expected it to happen, but not unexpected. The next thing that happened is that the hoped for move to have the budget iPhone become an annual event rather than something that happens every few years, that came to pass. So when Apple named the most recent budget iPhone the iPhone 16e, we all took that as a hint from Apple that there would be a 17e, an 18e, etc. We still don't know if there will be an 18e, but it seems even more likely now because there is in fact an iPhone 17e. So, as Six Colors put it, iPhone launches iPhone 17e adding MagSafe and doubling the bay storage. The MagSafe's a big deal. One of the biggest compromises for non-techie geeky users of the 16E was that it was not MagSafe compatible. You couldn't put it on a Qi charging pad. It was a reasonable compromise for a massively cheaper phone, but it was a compromise that didn't affect the nerdy people. It affected regular folk, and that's probably, in hindsight, not the world's best compromise to make. That may have been needed for technical reasons. It may have been done grudgingly. We can't know what's going on inside Apple. Either way, they found a fix. So MagSafe is the biggest change from a non-techie person, because the techie people don't buy the 17E, right? Those of us who obsess about number of cores and amount of RAM, we're not buying a 16 or a 17E. But the people who do buy 16 or 17Es are exactly the kind of people who have a Qi-based thingy in the dashboard of their car and want to clunk their phone to it, and they buy a cheap iPhone and they try to clunk it to it and it falls off. Cranky. Problem solved. Also moving to an A19 chip, 48 megapixel camera, so a little bump, and as we got from the headline from Six Colors, double the base storage. What does that mean? That means 256 gigabytes of base storage is what that means. What do I mean by nicer camera? Well, fusion lens, which gives us a smarter selfie cam, which is nice. And if you already have a 16E and you adore your case and you might be tempted by the 17E's MagSafiness, well, don't worry, you don't have to get a new case, because existing 16E cases will still fit the 17E. So the industrial design has not shifted, just the innards. Apple has also ended the sale of a whole bunch of products, because everything I've mentioned so far is a replacement. So these things are all replacing other things. And so, of course, the things they're replacing are gone, because the days when Apple would keep selling older designs seem to be gone or going very quickly. And we're moving to this idea of the cheaper phone is a new design rather than last year's phone sold for less. Okay, so all of this so far, it's already a lot, but it's not earth-shattering, it's not unexpected. It's very much in line with the rumours. We did have pretty strong rumours. There was some sort of a very novel MacBook on the way that was going to be genuinely more affordable. Well, it's a truly novel product. That is the biggest news of the week of special events, and they really pushed the boat out here. They called it the MacBook Neo, and it's very new. It really is very new. Ars Technica probably have the best one-sentence headline I found. The $599 MacBook Neo is Apple's long-awaited colourful, lower-cost MacBook. Colourful, you say? Yeah, for a given value of colourful. We have silver, doesn't need explanation. We have indigo. I'm afraid I'm bad with colours. I had to go figure out what is indigo. It's a dark bluey purple. Something Apple call blush, which to my mildly colourblind eyes looks like a pastel pink. And something Apple called citrus, which to my eye looks A, adorable. B, if I was buying one of these, would be the one I'd buy, but it is in fact a pastel yellow. The A18 Pro powered MacBook Neo is Apple's lowest price ever. Now, it's A18 powered. So that is the chip from Pro iPhones of a few years ago is now powering a little notebook. Now, Apple, this is an interesting reversal, because Apple used to brag that their iPhone chips were PC powerful. You know, powerful enough. PC level chips are powering our phones. Well, now we have a phone level chip powering our PCs. But again, if they're the same level, that makes perfect sense. Now, one way to get the cost down is to not have a giant amount of SKUs, stock key units, I think is what that stands for, stock key units, I think so. Basically, unique different models to build and keep track of. So there are, in fact, two. There are two models, four colors, two models, that's 2 times 4, 8 total SKUs. Very, very limited compared to the number of permutations on a lot of Apple's other products. The base model is 256 gigs of storage and no Touch ID sensor. For an extra $100, you can have 512 gigabytes of storage and a Touch ID sensor. For all of this, you get 16 hours of battery life on a liquid retina display. That's a lovely display. And compared to the typical PC display, that's a really lovely display. Compared to Apple's best current displays, right, it's an older Apple display. But you're not, you shouldn't be comparing a $599 laptop to a $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 laptop. You should be comparing it to a $600 PC. And then that screen stands up very well. And that's 16 hours of battery life. Yeah, it's less than the MacBook Air, but it's perfectly competitive with the PC stuff in the same price range. You also don't get as nice of a camera, 1080p. It'll have to do with that. Spatial audio speakers, they're much less cool than the speakers in modern MacBook Airs and stuff. Just dual mics, not these beamforming multi-directional ones we're used to. Not bad. Probably the biggest compromise, which would be a big deal were it not for the unified memory architecture of all of Apple's chips, including the A-series chips, 8 gigs of RAM. That's not upgradable. Remember, 8 SKUs in total, 4 colors, 2 storage amounts. No variability of RAM. No option to pay more to get more. No. This is 8 gigs of RAM. Full stop, end of story. Probably because the iPhones that had those chips originally were also 8 gigs of RAM, full stop, end of story. So these MacBooks are 8 gigs of RAM, full stop, end of story. On a PC that is... But with Apple's unified memory architecture, that's actually fine. And the hands-on have proven this, by the way, because the reason they had a press event was so that the press could get hands-on, so that they could feel for themselves that even though some of these numbers look small, the thing performs really nicely for the kind of tasks that people who buy $600 laptops are going to do with them. You're not going to edit a Final Cut Pro movie very quickly on these things, but that's not what they're for. And there are, of course, compromises, and one of the interesting ones is that there are only 2 ports, USB-C shaped ports, but that's just the shape. USB-C means nothing about the data that goes through them. USB-C is a description of the shape of the hole. One of those 2 ports, the one furthest to the back, is USB-3 under the hood and supports DisplayPort. So the 2 protocols that can go over that wire are USB-3 and DisplayPort. The other one really is intended for an accessory like a mouse or a keyboard or something, because it's USB-2, no DisplayPort. You can charge through both of them, which is nice, but you must plug the screen into the back port. You must plug a fast hard drive into the back port to get its full speed. And that may sound confusing, and there's no hardware labeling, which would need to be very tiny and hard to read anyway, on the ports. Instead, Apple have opted to do it in software. If you plug something that needs more oomph or would benefit from more oomph into the port that's only to USB 2 and can't do DisplayPort and stuff, the Mac will tell you on screen, hey, that thingy you just plugged into that hole, plug it into the hole next to it. I'm sure it'll be phrased better than that, but you get the idea. There are, of course, compromises all the way down. A nice analysis of them from the Mac Observer. Everything Apple removed to reach $599. And then we have a hands-on review from Ars Technica. And their headline, I think, summed it up quite well. Apple build quality at a substantially lower price. They've had their hands on, they've played with it. It is a Mac. It is worthy of the name Mac. And it's $600. A lot of interesting analysis, obviously. Very fascinating product. I really liked the take from Six Colors. Apple makes a Trojan horse play for the education market, because as great as these prices already were, education get them for $100 less. That's $499 for the base model with not a lot of storage and no Touch ID. And some people are like, but the education people don't have Touch ID. Yeah. I work in education. I know for a fact that's a feature, not a bug. Because shared devices, Face ID, Touch ID, no good to you. Wasted expensive capability. So for the education market, that $499 price point is infinitely more important than a Touch ID sensor you will never use. The storage is also not a big deal because, again, shared devices, you don't store your stuff on device. What I think a lot of people who are not in education don't know is that Apple offers something called Apple School Manager, which allows you to create special controlled and limited Apple IDs for your students that protect their privacy. And those Apple IDs are managed Apple IDs. Those Apple IDs are not like a normal Apple ID. The closest thing they are to a normal Apple ID is they're a bit like juggled accounts in a family plan. But they're managed accounts under an Apple School Manager. And Apple School Manager allows you to create people who effectively act as administrators for the school. And those administrators for the school can generate Apple IDs for the students, allocate them to the different students. There's mechanisms for distributing them. The students can then use those Apple IDs, but those Apple IDs are very limited in the sharing they can do. So you can't accidentally end up on iMessage with an evil person on somewhere randomly on the internet. All that kind of stuff is limited down to within the school and things like that. And so as well as them being child-friendly Apple IDs, they come with 20 gigs of storage, as opposed to the standard 5. So if you're a student in education, you don't keep your stuff on your shared device, be it a shared iPad, shared Mac, whatever. And there are tools for sharing iPads among students, by the way. They just haven't made it outside of Apple School Manager. And so for education, what you want is a screen to access your managed Apple ID with your 20 gigs of storage. So that 256 gigs of storage isn't a problem either. What you're trying to do is compete in a tender with a Google netbooky-like thing, whatever they're called, Pixels? Google Chrome devices, they're the ones. Or with a cheapy Windows PC. I was going to say cheap and cheerful Windows PC, but there's nothing cheerful about those really low-end Windows devices. They're plasticky and awful. This is very compelling. With my education hat on, this is very compelling. In an Apple School Manager environment, these are fantastic devices. Very clever play here. Also, for those friends and family who probably should use an iPad but are not ready to because, well, I've always had a computer, and that's not a real computer. Here's a computer for them. Or as Apple Insider put it, MacBook Neo proves Apple can build a $599 laptop without cheapening the Mac. There's many, many famous quotes from Steve Jobs over the years going, yeah, we don't build a cheap iMac because we don't ship junk. We don't ship garbage, I think was the actual word he used. I think he used the words junk and garbage in various quotes. And this is the thing, based on the hands-on and stuff, this isn't junk or garbage, but it is $699 or $499 for education. And I think the best reasoned analysis of all of this I have seen is on Tidbits, and the headline captures why I love this article perfectly. The MacBook Neo's carefully considered compromises. Tidbooks' article is a carefully considered analysis of those carefully considered compromises. Excellent reading, highly recommend it. So, all in all, quite a week. Useful little link in the show notes from the Mac Observer. Every new product announced. If you just want a little menu of all of the things you could spend your money on, there you go. Link in show notes, lesserstock.ie. And then, of course, we don't have any announcement-y style videos. We have shiny marketing videos. But if you want to get a look at these products, then Mac Observer, again, have very kindly collected all the videos into one post where you can scroll through, click play. So that is also linked in the show notes. Let us wrap up this short month's worth of long Apple news with a few other quick stories that made the news in February 2025. Apple continued to experiment with AI in smaller ways ahead of the promised and much anticipated Apple Intelligence updates. What do I mean? Xcode 26.3 adds support for Claude, Codex, and other agentic tools via MCP. If that's an acronym you've been seeing all over the place, you don't understand. The Model Context Protocol. It is a standard protocol for AI agents to consume services. It's like an API for AI. Very powerful if we're going to have, if we want to have agents that aren't susceptible to browser-based attacks, the answer is to give them their own special door for agents, specially configured to be securable against agents, not designed for human beings clicking mices. MCP is that. It is a fledgling but very important AI technology. So being able to use MCP to expand the capability of Xcode, that is good. That is clever. That is good use of AI. So that is good to see. Small scale, so Apple can experiment. Good to see. Apple launches the Sales Coach app to their store employees. This replaces something they used to have called Seed, which was like a sort of a help-based app where you could look things up. Well, now it's a chat agent that will look things up from the same database of truth about Apple products. So this is a chatbot with a very, very focused job, trained very heavily on very specific pieces of data. It's a nice playpen for LLMs, large language models. So I think it's interesting to see Apple doing this in this controlled way with their employees and self-service staff. Sorry, their employees, store and service employees. It's a clever way to play in this sandbox without risking embarrassment in the eyes of the public, because they can't release a terrible Siri chatbot as their first big upgrade to Siri, but they can mess around with these things internally and learn their lessons that way. Google have finally released a YouTube app for the Apple Vision Pro. Early review? Well, the Apple Insider don't... I think damning with faint praise is how I would put the Apple Insider's summary. YouTube's bare minimum app for Apple Vision Pro is better than nothing. Yeah, okay. We have some unusual pre-announcements for iOS 26.4. The Apple Podcast app will combine video and audio into a single show, so you can start watching the show in video and then switch to audio only. It uses fancy pants protocols. Basically, the podcaster has a lot of work to do if they're going to do this and traditional distribution media outside of Apple Podcasts. Maybe tooling will make that work evaporate for people using, you know, podcast production tool chains. We shall see how much this takes off. It's interesting technology, that's for sure. They're adopting standards here, not making their own. It's interesting. Link in show notes to Mac Stories explaining it and an Apple press release. And then the iPhone has become the first consumer product certified for handling classified NATO data. I find this hilarious with my cybersecurity hat on, because one of the biggest telltale signs that a product is overselling its security is when the branding people in the corporation call it military-grade encryption or military-grade security. And Apple are not claiming military-grade. However, Apple are rightly proud of the fact that they're off-the-shelf iPhones. They're consumer phones you can buy in a supermarket store, are secure enough to handle classified NATO data out of the box. That is a reward for the work Apple have been putting into security from the Apple Silicon level up. I, given my job, I'm going to give Apple a great big pat on the head for that. Well done, Apple. And that is a nice story to round out a month's worth of Apple news. I have been your host, Bart Bouchatz. You can find me personally at bartb.ie, but that website is a bit of a train wreck still. So instead of doing that, I would recommend instead you direct your browser to let's-talk.ie, which is the website for this show. You will find at that website detailed show notes listing every story that informed my thinking on this month's Apple News. And what you will notice is I do a lot of reading in a month. And what you get is a digested, considered, slightly more opinionated than it used to be, but I'm getting settled into becoming a bit more editorial and a little bit less, oh, I'll just state the facts. No one's complained, by the way, about the new format in the show, so I think we've decided this is the new format of the show. Anyway, all the stories that inform my thinking and my opinions that you have heard, let's-talk.ie. By the way, isn't it pretty? I'm so happy with that new website. If you're wondering who the amazing people are doing the graphics, they're a company called the Icon Factory. They make great Mac apps. They do really cool pixel portraits if you're looking for a new social media avatar. My personal social media avatar is one of those pixel portraits you can buy from them, and it's gorgeous. I'm becoming ever more fond of it as time goes on. Okay, you will also find big obvious buttons to support the show. I want to give a really big thank you to everyone who has ever supported the show in any way. Your help is greatly appreciated. Those of you who continue to support the show today, thank you very much. It is because of you that this show exists. There are no sponsors, there are no ads. The one source of income for this show is the listeners, and I thank you so much for that opportunity to do this without conflicts of interest. That is so liberating. And supporting the show does not have to be financial. It can be Patreon for regular donations, which help me pay the bills, PayPal for one-off donations that help me buy hardware and software as and when needed. But you can also just spread the word. Share the show, spread the word. That helps drive up the numbers, which means there's more opportunities for other people to support the show financially. I'm going to stop prattling on at this stage. Like I say, a lot of news crammed into this show today. Rather pleased with myself that it's not too far over an hour. It is over an hour, but it's not massively over an hour. Show notes, letsjusttalk.ie, my rather personal website, bartb.ie. I have been your host, Bart Buschotz. Until next time, happy computing.